podcast of the Game Nashville Sports Network.
It's Mr. Worldwide, Agent A, reporting live from Cape Canaveral. MK, Big Sight Fest Rap.
Back in time.
Welcome into the Air Raid with Parker Kelly on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Across the Game Nashville Sports Network, guess what? I have good news. We are 5 Saturdays away from the official start of the college football season. And the reason I say official is because, in my mind, week 1 is the start of the college football season, not week 0. Week 0 is more so like an appetizer to the main course. And yes, we have Iowa State and Kansas State playing in Dublin, Ireland, and that game has major Big 12 title implications early. I'm going to be glued to that game 100%, but week 1 is when the whole country starts playing. So to me, that is the official start of the college football regular season. I have a loaded show for today because we're getting closer and closer. President Trump issued an executive order for college sports, and that has lit the internet on fire. So I have to talk about it. And as much as I don't want to talk about what's going on in the courtroom, I want to actually talk about real football. This is big news, so I have to address it. Big Ten Media Days happened this week in Las Vegas. There were some headlines, some stories that came out that kind of rubbed me the wrong way that I'm going to get to as well. I have some more conference realignment intel that I'm going to get into. And then for the final segment, I have a very fun segment planned. I promise you're not going to want to miss that. But before I go any further, please make sure you're subscribed to the Game Nashville Sports Network podcast, where you will never miss an episode of The Air Raid with Parker Kelly. And also, you'll get access to all of our great podcasts that we're doing here at 102.5 The Game. So please make sure you're subscribed to that. Okay, let's go ahead and get into it. So President Trump issued an executive order on college athletics. Now, this has been something that has been talked about for a while. Tons of speculation that he was going to, and he, I mean President Trump, that he was going to take some sort of action to attempt to fix the mess that is going on behind the scenes in college sports. So as of Thursday, President Trump released his long-awaited executive order. It's a 5-page document titled Saving College Sports. Now, of course, as you all know, this was met with a wave of optimism because as soon as the president or the government intervenes with anything college athletics, it's always a positive thing. I say that sarcastically because the internet and college football fans and media, they're very torn on how they feel about this. And I can't necessarily fault them for that because it is a tricky thing. If you would have asked me pre-NIL, if I would have wanted government intervention in college athletics, I probably would have tried to check you into an insane asylum. But because of where we are today, because the NCAA can't pee without getting the front of their pants wet, this is where we're at today. And they haven't been able to fix it. So the College Sports Commission comes along and they're attempting to fix it. But Brian Seely, who is the kind of the leader of this College Sports Commission, he has told fans and others to be patient because this is going to take a while. And I agree, a certain amount of patience is going to be required to at least see this thing through. Now, President Trump has issued an executive order. And basically, what this is, I'm going to try to lay this out as simply as possible because you can kind of get lost. And I did when I was reading this. You can kind of get lost in the minutia of all this. So I'm going to try to really explain this as simply as possible so that it is easily digestible. So Trump basically has delegated to the members of his cabinet to create a policy, and this is all laid out in the executive order. Basically, this policy aims to accomplish four things. One, it wants to protect scholarships for the non-revenue sports. So football, basketball, those are your money makers for most schools. Your non-revenue sports are your Olympic sports, gymnastics, track and field. I could even include softball in it. The sports that make not as much money as the big sports like football and basketball. Soccer could even be included in that as well. And basically what this is it's saying if your athletic department brings in over $150 million, you have to increase the number of scholarships to go to these non-revenue sports. However, if your school brings in or your athletic department brings in $50 million, you can keep the scholarship limit the way that it's already set up. So basically, when this House settlement was passed and the salary cap was introduced of $20.5 million that can be allocated to all sports across campus. Obviously, football is going to get I would even go as far to say 3/4 of that money. Basketball would probably get what's left over or a majority of what's left over, and then a little bit is sprinkled on the other sports. So President Trump is at least trying to save these non-revenue sports because there have been some schools like Washington State that have cut ties with some of these non-revenue sports. There was a school that I believe cut the field portion of the track and field. There was a school that cut their tennis program. So President Trump is basically trying to save these sports with this executive order. Another thing, this executive order is trying to prohibit third-party pay-for-play. Now, the executive order doesn't necessarily define what this means, but basically, the concept of NIL is that athletes are able to profit off of their name, image, and likeness through marketing purposes, through business purposes. But where this all went wrong is collectives and third-party organizations basically just started paying these players to get them to one, commit to their school, and two, get them to play for their school, which was not the purpose of NIL, what it was intended for in the first place. But because the NCAA didn't clearly lay out guidelines, that's where everything got murky. So what this executive order, again, is attempting to do is third parties cannot pay money to get athletes. Athletes can use their NIL for marketing and business purposes. Again, the order doesn't define what that means, so this may be subject to more litigation, which is not necessarily a good thing. The executive order also attempts to basically not have athletes be employed. This has kind of been a hot topic in the world of college sports because now that this idea of amateurism is kind of dying, there's been this debate of, okay, should athletes be employees? Should they not be? This executive order doesn't want athletes to be considered employees. Danny White, the athletic director at Tennessee, has been very open about the way forward is through a collective bargaining agreement. And he's gone as far to say athletes don't have to be employees, or they don't have to be considered employees by the school to be able to collective bargain. I'm personally interested in that idea to see how that works out. And the last thing that this executive order attempts to do is limit liability protection. Basically, what that means is the NCAA was spineless. They were weak because everything they did in this era has got challenged and taken to court. And there's no clear way forward if at the 11th hour of every day, something new is getting taken to court. There's not room or a clear path for progress if everything is getting taken to the courtroom. So whether this executive order, who knows if it'll actually accomplish much of anything, that's really up to the cabinet members, Trump's cabinet members, to determine how far this will go. But they also, you got to remember, they have more pressing matters to attend to than intervening in NIL purposes. So the three questions I have: who enforces this prohibition on pay for play? We don't know. What is the penalty for if a collective happens to pay an athlete pay for play? What's the penalty? Who's enforcing it? And the last thing, what is prohibiting third-party pay-for-play? How do you differentiate a business opportunity for an athlete versus pay-for-play? I think this is all, it can get kind of confusing. So there needs to be a standard, a clear definition of what separates the two. But the truth is, nobody knows if this is actually going to work. There's a good chance that it doesn't actually accomplish much. We'll just kind of have to sit back and see how it goes. And it's kind of the same thing with the College Sports Commission. Coaches and athletic directors and many people have been clamoring for guardrails, for rules, while this College Sports Commission and now this executive order, they're attempting to do just that. But will people, when it comes to actually following rules, are they going to do that? So we still have to see how that pans out. We're going to go ahead and head to a break. When we come back, there were a lot of headlines made at Big Ten Media Days, and I have to talk about it. That's coming up next. What used to belong to the SEC now belongs to the Big Ten, as that is the Big Ten on CBS theme music. And I think it was kind of fitting to play because Big Ten Media Days happened this past week in Las Vegas, and there was a major difference between Big Ten Media Days and SEC Media Days. Usually, with SEC Media Days that happened last week in Atlanta, typically in previous years, there have been a lot of fireworks during SEC Media Day weeks, whether that is Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban getting into it, or whether that's Lane Kiffin making a comment. You know how it goes. There's always a national headline that comes out of SEC Media Days. And this past week, the big headline coming out of SEC Media Days wasn't, you know, anything that a coach said. In fact, it was something that Greg McElroy said, hinting that Nick Saban could possibly come out of retirement to coach again, which he claims wasn't actually true. I don't really know. But anyways, that was really the big story coming out of SEC Media Days, but it's funny because it was an analyst that started all of that and not a coach. The good thing about SEC Media Days, the refreshing thing, was there was a lot of football talk. There wasn't a lot of off-the-field drama talk. It was strictly about what is going to take place on the field. And as a fan myself and as a host of the show, I really like talking about the football matters. I don't like talking about what's going on in the courtroom. All these legal issues, all the legalese out there, because I feel like to cover college football in the off season, or we don't believe in that word on this show. I don't even know what an off season is. But in order to cover college football when games aren't actually being played, it's almost like you have to be a legal expert because of everything that's been taken to court. Well, Big Ten Media Days, there were a lot of headlines that were made. Kurt Cignetti, the head coach at Indiana, made a comment that was a direct shot to the SEC. So recently, Indiana canceled a home-and-home series with the University of Virginia. And he made a comment that the reason that Indiana canceled the Virginia home-and-home was because they were, quote, adopting an SEC scheduling format. Okay, Jed Fish, the head coach at the University of Washington, quote, I'm not interested in scheduling anybody in the Power Four if we don't have to. And this is even going outside of the Big Ten here. Rhett Lashley at SMU in the ACC took a shot at the depth of the SEC. Here's what I'm really struggling to understand, because I know these coaches are not dumb, and I don't think they're idiots. I don't think they're stupid. I think they're very bright minds. But what are we doing, guys? What are we doing? Okay, I don't agree with the fact that during spring meetings, the SEC handed out a booklet of all these ratings and statistics proving that it is tough to play in the SEC. I don't like all that propaganda. I'm not really a huge proponent of that. But here's the bottom line. The SEC, in terms of strength of schedule in the FBS, the hardest strength of schedule, 1 through 11, all belong to SEC teams. That is just the fact of the matter. Indiana, and I'm not going to argue if they deserve to be in the playoff or not last year over a team like Alabama, because I do believe Indiana was deserving because they won the games that were in front of them. The strategy right now, or at least the incentive, is to not schedule tough opponents in the non-conference because you don't want to schedule an extra loss, especially if you're playing in a conference like the SEC or the Big Ten. And I believe that is due to the way the playoff format is currently set up, because with teams like SMU and teams like Indiana, who didn't have tough strength of schedules, they went out and they won their games and they got rewarded for it when it came time to the selection process to get into the college football playoff. So that's why I've talked about, when it comes to this 8-9 game SEC conference schedule, what's the incentive for the SEC to go to a 9th game if, one, they already play a tough schedule, and two, if you schedule an extra loss, that might hurt your chances of getting into the college football playoff. In terms of strategy, I think this is smart, but for Kurt Cignetti to say he's adopting an SEC scheduling format, hey, Kurt, do you want Florida's schedule? Would you like to play Oklahoma's schedule? Would you like to play Texas A&M's schedule? Indiana last year, before the Ohio State game, their schedule was ranked in the hundredths in terms of a strength of schedule. And after they played Ohio State, I believe it got bumped up to the mid-50s, but still, there are teams like Florida who have an absolute Hunger Games of a schedule 2 years in a row. Oklahoma, very tricky schedule as well. I believe they have the third hardest strength of schedule in America. Texas A&M is up there as well. I believe they're top five in the country. So I just don't understand the need for these coaches to come out and attack the SEC for their non-conference schedule or for playing FCS teams in November. when there's plenty of evidence out there that the SEC still plays a gauntlet of a schedule in the regular season. And I don't see teams from the Big Ten chomping at the bit to trade schedules with an SEC team. It's just not happening. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't think the Big Ten is a great league, because they are. And they have some great teams in that league and some teams that I'm interested to see play this year that I believe could be dark horse contenders, Illinois being one of them. So I don't think these guys are stupid or idiots or anything, but like, the comments are just so unnecessary. And then for Rhett Lashley, who's a coach in the ACC, taking a shot at the depth of the SEC, I'm sorry, I didn't realize the ACC was so deep. I mean, you have Miami and you have Clemson. Florida State had a down year last year. I expect them to be much better this year. Obviously, you have SMU, who made it to the college football playoff. Georgia Tech is could be another good team this year. But can we just, are we really going to pretend like the ACC is on the same playing field as the SEC or the Big Ten? Because if that's the game we're playing, it's all a facade. It's not real. Now, that's no disrespect to the ACC, because I love the ACC, but it's just, they're not equal. They're not equal to the SEC. They're not equal to the Big Ten. So, again, these comments just feel so forced. James Franklin was also very vocal, the head coach at Penn State. He was very vocal about the playoff format and what that is going to look like. And he said that if we're going to do a 5+11 or whatever the format may be, that all the conferences need to play the same amount of conference regular season games, whether that be 8 or whether that be 9. I just don't understand the obsession with this. I don't. The Big Ten plays 9 conference games. The SEC plays 8. But just because the SEC plays 8 doesn't mean that they play an easy schedule, because clearly, and the stats back it up, that's just not the case. And there are most of the SEC 8-game conference schedules are harder than the Big Ten, who play 9 conference games. I just don't understand the obsession with it, and I think it's really silly. And then one last thing that I wanted to address. So Nico Iamaleava, the quarterback at UCLA, finally broke the silence. He hasn't talked to reporters, hasn't talked to the media since the whole University of Tennessee incident. But he had an interesting comment that's caught a lot of traction. He talked about the reports out there of why he left Tennessee. He claimed that they were false. He said that going back home to Southern California, where he was originally from, was something that was in the back of his head the whole time. It wasn't about the money, but it was about being closer to home. Okay. I heard Kirk Herbstreit on a podcast recently, and this is a guy that's very involved in the college football community. He said that he heard that Nico Iamaleava's dad went to Josh Heupel and the coaching staff and said that they needed to upgrade at the positions around him, or else they would possibly leave. And there were also reports out there about Nico wanting more money. So I believe it was a bunch of different factors. But basically, Nico made it seem like that, hey, I just wanted to go back home, when really there was a lot more. And to say that a lot of these reports were false, I mean, there were some very reliable reporters covering this. So it wasn't false. But that is in the past. I've talked about this a lot, but so many headlines coming out of Big Ten Media Days, And just a lot of these comments just really, really rubbed me the wrong way. Okay. We're going to have a little bit more a positive, upbeat segment coming up. I have some conference realignment intel and then a really fun segment for the end of the show. So stay tuned for that. Okay, so I have some more conference realignment intel. I did a show however long ago it was, I can't remember, where I basically laid out Texas State moving to the Pac-12, what that meant for the Sun Belt, who was going to replace Texas State in the Sun Belt. Turns out that it was Louisiana Tech, and that was going to be a smaller wave of conference realignment. Well, the news came out on Thursday that the University of North Carolina was potentially exploring a move to the SEC with the next wave of conference realignment. And my initial first reaction was no, because one, I'm not a fan of conference realignment, and I'm sure a lot of you aren't either. But I saw this news and I was thinking to myself, okay, so you remember that whole ACC Clemson Florida State debacle where Clemson and Florida State basically wanted to test the waters and see, or Clemson more so than Florida State wanted to test the waters and see how much it would cost if they were to leave the SEC. I think Florida State was a little bit more apt about leaving the conference than Clemson was, but all in all, it got resolved. Commissioner of the ACC, Jim Phillips, I believe this was a very smart move on his end to be able to retain those two programs because they are more notable programs in the ACC, and also he kept them in the conference for one, but also the way they're kind of revenue is going to be distributed is based on a formula of wins and losses plus viewership and that sort of thing. So the teams that win the most get the most viewership, who go deep into the playoffs, they're the teams that are going to get a larger chunk of the pie. So this would be your teams like Clemson, Miami, Florida State in a good year. So That's how it's going to work. And here's the interesting thing about this kind of deal with the ACC is the buyout in terms of the number that it would cost to leave the conference, it decreases each year of this deal. And I told you in a while back, if you've been listening for a while, you've definitely heard me say this, 2031, that's the year to circle on your calendar, because that's the year where this next wave of seismic conference realignment could take place. And here's why. 2031 is the year in which the buyout fee for the ACC, if you want to leave the conference, is at its lowest. So it goes from the $100 million to all the way down to $70 million in 2031. Now, $70 million to the average person is generational wealth, but to a big time program, that's pocket change. So if these teams are serious about wanting to leave the ACC, 2031 is going to be the year to do it. And that could be the year we see a North Carolina, if they wanted to move to the SEC, which I would hate, and I'm sure you would hate too, that would be the year. If Clemson was to leave the ACC, that would be the year. Florida State, same thing. So 2031, again, that is a year to circle on your calendar. I'm going to provide a bit of optimism. So recently, there was also a report that Memphis offered, I believe it was reported by On3's Brett McMurphy, they offered a payment of up to $250 million over a five-year span to join the Big 12. And the Big 12 and Commissioner Brett Yormark declined the offer. Now, this is interesting for multiple reasons. One, a school is offering to pay you to join the conference, and we've seen people in this sport, in this industry, not even bat an eye if they're offered more money. But Brett Yormark and the Big 12, they were offered money by a school, but yet they still turned it down. And secondly, this is the second time Memphis was declined membership by the Big 12. In 2023, Memphis was bypassed by the conference, but yet the Big 12 decided to add UCF and Cincinnati and Houston, who were all in the same conference as Memphis in the AAC, now known as the American Conference. It rebranded itself. So that is really interesting, because this is the second time Memphis has been bypassed, but yet the Big 12 went and added UCF, Houston, and Cincinnati. Now, I believe that Brett Yormark by declining membership to Memphis, I believe he's looking out in the best interest of college football, but yet I look at the additions that were made, and the Big 12 is all over the place. It literally spans from Utah and Salt Lake City to Orlando, Florida, home of UCF. So I can't say that by declining a invitation or declining membership to Memphis, he did it because he wants the Big 12 to be regional, because the Big 12 is not regional. But I just find it very interesting. And not to mention, this is the second time that they have been bypassed. So the SEC could potentially do the same thing. If they don't want North Carolina, they could decline. They don't want Clemson, they don't want Florida State, they could decline. But who's to say that maybe the Big Ten, or I don't know, would the Big 12 be willing to take on a Clemson, a Florida State? Who knows? A North Carolina? Maybe. I know for a fact the Big Ten definitely wants to expand into that part of the country. I don't know what's on the horizon with all this. We could be heading towards a super conference. Who knows? Or super conferences. Who knows? But it's just something to keep your eyes peeled out for. 2031. Remember that date. There's also the potential for Memphis to join the Pac-12. Last September, they were offered an invitation to join the conference, but Memphis Athletic Director Ed Scott declined because it was, quote, a bad deal, and not to mention that Memphis would have to travel 20,000 miles to compete in the conference, literally almost circumnavigating the globe. Texas State joined the Pac-12 recently. So now Memphis, they're wanting to get in on joining a power conference. And I've read some reports that there is a possibility that they could join the Big East in hoops and all of their other sports, but football could compete in the Pac-12 because it's more... It's easier for them to manage the travel if they're only traveling on the weekends, whereas, you know, some of your other sports like basketball, like swimming and diving and those sports, they have to travel during the week. So if they join the Big East regionally, it makes a little bit more sense than if they were to join the Pac-12. But yeah, this dominoes are starting to fall because of Texas State moving to the Pac-12, and now Texas State's replacement in the Sun Belt, Louisiana Tech, that leaves a hole open in Conference USA. Who's going to fill that? I don't know. But that is the latest conference realignment intel. We're going to go ahead and hit one more break, and when we come back, I have a really fun segment planned. You don't want to miss it. final segment here on the Air Raid with Parker Kelly. I told you this was going to be a really fun segment. So two questions that I wanted to answer as we wrap up the show here. What does a modern day dynasty look like in college football? And I really think that depends on what your definition of dynasty is. And honestly, I think your definition of dynasty should change. Let me give you an example. So Alabama in the 2010s, that was probably the greatest dynasty of all time in college football. That run that they went on with Nick Saban winning 6 national championships during his time as the head coach of the Crimson Tide. Things have changed, though, since NIL was introduced and the transfer portal. This is something guys like Kirby Smart have been saying over the past couple of years, and that is the quality of depth is different. When you have a team like Alabama in the 2010s, their backups and their third strings, yeah, like when they came in as true freshmen, they might not have been playing so much, but a couple years down the road, they get developed, and eventually a lot of those guys ended up becoming first-round draft picks. So their third stringers ended up being Sunday guys. Well, in today's day and age, we take a team like Georgia, who has been on a dominant run over the last couple of years of college football. They're having to do something that the University of Georgia hasn't had to do in a while, and that's rely on true freshmen and younger guys who are their backups who are going to have to play a significant role on that defense. And that's something that, you know, Kirby Smart, one of the best players on that defense last year was KJ Bolden, a true freshman safety. I haven't been able to recall a lot of times where there have been true freshmen playing on Kirby Smart's defense. Outside of guys like Malachi Starks, who played as a true freshman, there haven't been a whole lot of guys that have played in year one for a Kirby Smart-led defense. So the quality of depth in college football is not what it used to be. So I believe your definition of dynasty has to change. Georgia, I feel like it is a great example. They won 2 straight national championships, and obviously in college football, and this hasn't even been a recent thing, just over the course of its history, winning 2 straight national championships has been extremely hard to do. But Georgia, by their standards last year, took a little bit of a step back. And I think that we're going to see teams, if they win a national championship, there may be a year and maybe the year after where they take a step back. Michigan is a great example. Michigan won the national championship in 2023, but basically their entire starting roster on the offensive and defensive side of the ball got drafted. So naturally, because they lost all of that production, they took a step back. Ohio State won the national championship last season. Most of their offense and defense got drafted. Are they going to take a step back this year? I don't know. Now, by Ohio State's definition of taking a step back, that could be 9-3, because the standard at Ohio State is to compete for national championships. So if they're 9-3, more than likely they probably won't be competing for a national championship, and that would be considered a step back. I think we're going to start seeing that in college football. I don't think we're going to see a coach win 6 national championships. I don't think, at least the way college football is currently constructed as of right now, I don't think we're going to see a coach win 6 national championships at the same school. I just don't think that is going to work in today's era of college football. Okay. One final question that I wanted to get to on the show before we wrap up. What is my perfect college football broadcast crew? And I've been actually thinking about this for a while, and I believe that I've come up with the perfect list. Okay. So my play-by-play guy, I was between two guys, but ultimately I feel like this is a no-brainer for me. My play-by-play guy is Joe Tessitore. Now, I'm sure a lot of you are surprised that I didn't say Chris Fowler. Chris Fowler was actually my other option if I didn't go with Joe Tessitore. But if you've ever listened to Joe Tessitore call a game, and I think of the Georgia-Georgia Tech game that he called at the end of November last season, Joe Tessitore has this unique capability to just capture the excitement of the moment with his voice. If you've ever listened to Joe Tessitore call a game and you truly take in every element of the broadcast, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But in my opinion, nobody has the ability to capture the emotion of a single moment like Joe Tessitore. So Joe Tessitore is my play-by-play guy. My color, Kirk Herbstreit. I think Kirk Herbstreit is the best in the business right now in terms of being a color analyst. Here's one of my favorite things about Kirk Herbstreit, and I actually see him getting dogged a lot for this, but I just can't understand. Kirk Herbstreit graduated and played at Ohio State University. But when I listen to Kirk Herbstreit give his analysis, whether that be on College Game Day or the Saturday primetime game on ABC or ESPN, Kirk Herbstreit is right down the middle. He doesn't show his Ohio State homerism at all. And I think that is one of his better qualities and why he's so good to listen to. And he just knows the game. And he's consumed with college football. So I think that Kirk Herbstreit is the best color guy in the business. My sideline, I would actually have a sideline analyst. That's something that the SEC Network has been doing, where they have your play-by-play, your color, and then you have a sideline analyst. And sideline analyst is a little bit different than a sideline reporter, because the sideline analyst is basically a part of a three-man broadcast crew, and he's giving his analysis from what he's seeing while he's standing on the field. So my sideline analyst would be Cole Kublik. Cole Kublik is a guy that I don't think gets enough recognition, but Cole Kublik, he honestly might know more about college football than almost anyone. The way that he's just able to rattle off these players, their stats, how they contribute to their team, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses, and how in-depth he's able to go on almost any player, any team. Cole Kublik is one of the most underrated analysts in all of college football. So Cole Kublik would be my sideline analyst, and I would have two sideline reporters, one for one team, another for the other team. So my sideline reporter number one, Laura Rutledge. Laura Rutledge, also feel like she's the best in the business. She is also the host of NFL Live, the host of SEC Nation, does sideline reporting for Monday Night Football, does sideline for big college football games. She's very versatile, very gifted, she's great at her job. So she would be my number one sideline reporter. And my other sideline reporter, Alyssa Lang, I feel like she's a rising star. She's primarily on the SEC Network, does the SEC games, but I feel like Alyssa Lang is a star in the making. So one more time, I'm going to go through my list. My play-by-play, Joe Tessitore, color, Kirk Herbstreit, sideline analyst, Cole Kublik, sideline reporter number one, Laura Rutledge, and sideline reporter number two, Alyssa Lang. Really fun episode today. If you haven't already subscribed to the Game Nashville podcast, please do that. You will never miss an episode of The Air Raid with Parker Kelly, and you'll also get access to all of our great podcasts that we're doing here at 102.5 The Game. I'll have another episode for you this same time next week. In the meantime, please be safe, and I will talk to you next week.
Check out all of our podcasts at thegamenashville.com or find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and all other major podcast platforms.